love espresso, drip coffee, and cold brew? With the Ninja Luxe Cafe, if you can crave it, you can brew it. Espresso? Balanced. Drip coffee? Rich. Cold brew? In a flash. With Barista Assist technology, you brew with no stress and no guesswork. And make perfect silky microfoam hands-free from dairy or plant-based milks. Bring the coffee house home and unlock your favorites with the Ninja Luxe Cafe.
Fully reclined after training.
Fully reclined, ready to go with your good self, the most soothing voice in rugby.
Radio 4 voice, as we... Welcome to another edition of After the Whistle. You will be saddened to hear that I'm riding solo today. Leon's finally got a flight out to Japan, working at the semi-final and final. Working is probably a very loose description of what I imagine he's doing whilst out there for a week without any games on. But I'm delighted to say, in Leon's absence, I've got with me Welsh legend Jamie Roberts. How are you, mate?
Right. Afternoon. How are you?
You're stuck into the biscuits already as well. Don't tell any of the coaches, mate. But we've got tons of stuff that I want to chat to you about: life, career, self development. Obviously, a bit about playing guitar with the Mannix, what it's been like in Japan. But before we get that information out of you and your thoughts on the games, I just want to hear from Leon. Leon's very kindly sent us a message from Japan.
So I'm over here in Japan now with Frank Haddon, former Edinburgh and Scotland coach. And Frank, well, it'd be wrong to not mention Scotland and Japan, having recently what's happened. What was your take on that? And if you were Scotland coach now, what would you be thinking?
Well, clearly you'd be bitterly disappointed because you've not made the quarterfinals, and that's got to be the number one target for every time we come to a World Cup. But obviously Japan have performed remarkably well. I mean, I sat in the stadium just waiting for them to make an error, but it never happened. I mean, the complexity of some of their handling and their attacking moves was just fantastic to watch. And to be able to play that tempo for that length of time was absolutely remarkable. Hats off.
Yeah, we witnessed some of their skill transfer between forwards and backs. It was amazing to watch. And I suppose we're here now for a World Cup as well. You've got your own World Cup experiences. So if I ask you a question, what is your most vivid, I suppose, your special World Cup memory, what would it be?
You mean apart from England getting knocked out of their own World Cup in 2015? No.
Yeah, apart from that one, yeah.
To be honest, the whole World Cup experience is so vivid. I mean, obviously, the Six Nations memories are pretty clear as well, but not as clear as the whole World Cup experience. The one thing that I remember really clearly about the start of that World Cup was we were brought together by the head of refereeing, Paddy O'Brien. Sid Miller was the president of the World Rugby at that particular time. And as usual, they went through a list of things that were going to be hot on, the referees were going to be hot on during the World Cup. Things like make sure the ball goes in straight, you know, the usual stuff. But the real bomb that landed that day was they said, well, we have decided that it's too easy to retain possession at the moment for the attacking side. And so in this World Cup, we're going to give benefit of the doubt to the defending side. And you could have heard a pin drop, and the coaches were told that this was not for discussion. This is what was going to happen. So everybody was a bit uncertain going into the first game. The first game was Argentina against France, probably at that time two of the best attacking sides in the world. And they both, in the first few minutes, tried to run the ball out of their own half and got penalised at the breakdown and conceded 3 points. And that, unfortunately, was the start of aerial ping pong, something that kind of blighted the game for a number of years. And so that unfortunately, was one of my strongest memories.
Okay, fine. And just to finish off then, so what is the best piece of advice that you've ever been given?
You mean apart from not running with scissors and eating yellow snow, that sort of stuff?
Although they are good pieces of advice, by the way.
Yes, I thought they might be. My old man didn't really say very much, but he frequently came out with some classics. And one that really comes to mind is, it's amazing what you can achieve if you don't care who takes the credit. And I have actually heard that written two or three places, so he probably didn't make it up himself, but it's remained pretty fresh in my memory from about 40 years ago.
Before you go, who do you think is going to win the World Cup 2019?
I felt from the start that there was really only three realistic contenders. And I have a sneaking suspicion it'll be South Africa, but I mean, I thought we'd be Ireland, so what do I know?
Okay, well, we'll see. We'll see here. Thank you very much.
Right, well, it's great to hear that Leon has actually been up to something whilst he's been out there chatting to former Scotland coach Frank Haddon. Jamie, he clearly had a bit of hatred towards the English. Is that, you know, it's always spoken about, isn't it? But is that commonplace across all the other nations, the Celtic nations?
I don't think so. Look, it's just the history for me. As you know, I'm a very proud Welshman.
Yeah.
Arguably, what you perceive as hatred probably stems from the fact that England have long been the best side, and it's just a feeling.
There's a right
complete
smile on your face.
Yeah,
you
it's a feeling
that.
Of exactly. And that, I think down the years, over the course of the last century, they probably have been the strongest side. They have a far bigger pool of players to pick from, and the other countries are relatively smaller.
When you say that, so Scotland. When I always think about Scotland, and they're probably one of the most historically, as an Englishman, one of the hardest places to go and play. They come along Bannockburn, you get all the drums and the bagpipes going and everything like that, but they literally have two professional teams.
Right, exactly.
It amazes me how they compete on the world stage at all, and I don't mean that patronisingly before I get a ream of messages, but...
And they're unregistered players.
Yeah.
You know, Wales, rugby's our first sport. The footballers, I hate me to say that, but, you know, for me, rugby's our principal sport, and so kids play rugby in the street. And look, it's not a hatred for England. I have a huge amount of respect for England and their players and what they play, how they play the game. And playing at Twickenham is an amazing experience, and when we host England as well. But there's a history about that fixture. And when you grow up as a kid and you get a sense of the occasion about when you play England, it's extra special to beat England.
That's a compliment, if anything.
Yeah, exactly. It's a compliment to the English, really.
And mate, you've been in Japan. I've been watching you you chatting on the sidelines, doing your commentary bit. What's it been like over there? I mean, you've been there firsthand. From a spectator watching on TV, it looks like they have bought into it like no other nation has a World Cup.
It was special. Look, ITV asked me to go out for 10 days.
Nice
so,
plug.
Yeah, love it. the network. They, yeah. asked me to go out for 10 days from the opening ceremony through to Wales, Australia. And, you know, I had a chat with Stuart Hooper at the club. Pre-season was long enough as it is this year. We did about 3 or 4 months. Pre-season and...
Three or 4 months. That
pre-season, yeah.
That
which is probably twice as long as anyone I'd ever done before. Because it's World Cup year and the Premiership started 7 weeks later this year than normal. And so having spoken to Stuart, fair play, he said he wasn't going to send them away of what is potentially a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, really, to go out there. Not now as a player, obviously, because I wasn't selected in the World Squad, but just to go out there and try my hand at broadcasting. So amazing experience, fantastic country, probably the most respectful and disciplined people I've ever met in my life. And by that, even the simple things, you know, queuing to get on a train. No one's pushing and shoving. Everyone stands in their queue. They get on the train in orderly fashion.
Not like the French or the Italians, then.
Or the London Underground.
Oh, yes.
In Japan, the most kind of disciplined approach to something like that. But only the small things, but you realise, wow, these people are very, very respectful. Very special people, and as you said, have taken to the World Cup like no other country, you know, certainly in my experience in rugby. You know, the occasion, sense of occasion at every match, you know, most of the games are sellouts, they're filled with, you know, kids singing the anthems, learning all the anthems to other countries. And yeah, just felt amazing. Amazing experience.
I love it. It's fascinating because I've never been there. I could actually listen to you talk about that for ages, but we should probably chat about the rugby. The Welsh played at the weekend.
Yep.
I have absolutely loved how they've been playing during this tournament. I was a little bit concerned as they were coming in because I felt like they'd been narrowly scraping through games and they weren't necessarily setting the world alight.
But that was the narrowest of scrapes yesterday.
It was. So they've been playing really well. What happened? What happened yesterday?
You say playing really well. I think they've played a risk-averse brand of rugby.
Mm.
Yes, they've scored tries. and they've put themselves in good position. They've defended very well, and I think tactically their kicking game has been spot on.
How do you think Bigger kicked at the weekend?
Tactically?
Yeah.
Well, his goal kicking was phenomenal.
Yeah, out of hand.
But just 9 in 10.
Some strange ones.
Yeah, there were some strange ones. Obviously, he kicks the ball a lot off penalty advantage, certainly in opposition 22. So when there's a pen advantage, he'll roll the dice. It's either a cross for a kick or a little dink and just hope for the bounce of the ball. It worked against Australia. You know, Hadley Parts is opening try. And it's worked other times in the tournament as well. But South Africa will be smart to that. And the interesting thing for me about this semi-final against South Africa is you've got two teams who play very similarly. Mm. The Springboks are very similar. They don't attack too much. They don't play to width too much. Mm. They're very direct. And they rely on their pressure game in defence, and they rely on the kicking game off the halfback. So it's going to be really intriguing, actually, how both sides approach that match. Because I guess you roll the dice and try and get into those wider channels, or do you potentially shoot yourself in the foot by doing so?
I just get the impression that it's going to be really disappointing that we'll see a really dull game against Wales and South Africa, because they'll go back to
or he who dares wins.
Yeah.
You know, in semi-finals, those who take risks, go out and play, fortune favours the brave. I tried to, at least three or four cliches in there.
That was beautiful. Because the Japanese came out, didn't they, against the South Africans, and probably they tried it. They were never going to win, I don't think. I never felt they were going to win. South Africans weren't going to let... They weren't going to be ambushed again like they were in Brighton 4 years ago. But actually, Japan did throw caution to the wind, didn't they? You know, early crossfield kicks going to the edges.
Well, Japan went and played. And as you said, you say that you could never see them winning. I think if they were a little bit smarter about how they played, the game would have been a bit closer. Australia, however, for me, they wanted to play like Australia with no respect for England.
Mm.
I saw Michael Checker's interview after, and he was like, you know, saying, look, I'm not going to change the way we play, our identity and how we want to approach the game. Call me naive, but we're not going to change. Well, actually, yes, they were naive.
Yeah.
Because their exits from their 22, their kicking strategy was awful. And the amount of times they gave England momentum on the front foot in their own half off terrible exit strategy. So it was naive from the Australians. But it's been exciting, World Cup. You know, privileged to be there, you know, to witness the opening ceremony and work at a few of the games and see the way the different teams have tried to play the game. That's the beauty of our sport, isn't it? There's many ways to go about playing it, and I think we've seen the full variety of how teams have approached it.
And just going back to the Welsh game at the weekend, obviously you had the Var Amina red card. Do you think if that hadn't have happened, I mean, he's had previous with sort of mind blowing moments of stupidity on the pitch. You know, we're all susceptible to a bit of red mist. Obviously, I've been there in the past. But do you think if he'd kept under control, would that have been a different outcome to the game of the weekend?
Likely. You know, Wales were very lucky to win at the weekend. And I called France as one of the dangerous sides in the tournament before the tournament started. I know this French side, with the ability they've got, Dupont, Vakatawa, Penaud, these players.
And they played at the weekend.
And they played, mate. And they were outstanding at the weekend. So I was nervous about the game, and certainly 25, 30 minutes in, I was extremely nervous. And then that red card happened.
Yeah.
About 50 minutes. So, you know, the France just completely did what France do. And it couldn't be more cliche France, could it?
Yeah.
It couldn't be. And Wales as well, probably butchered a few opportunities. And you're just thinking, oh, is this not our day? But they finally got there through, again, France's errors.
So fast forward quickly to that semi-final coming up. Who's going to stand out for you in that Welsh team? Who's going to make the difference at the weekend?
That's a good question. Look, if we try and beat South Africa at scrum and lineout and try and arm wrestle them, I think we'll lose. We need to go and play, and we need to put pressure on the wider channels and their wingers. I think the All Blacks showed in their opening match against the Springboks that they can expose their wingers.
Yeah.
Yes, Colby and Mapimpi, they're good players attacking wise, but I think defensively they're a bit suspect, especially in the air, and they're prone to making a few poor decisions. So, you know, if we can get the ball to those wider channels, we can cause problems. And you know, I think Big George is due a big game.
He has been quiet.
He has been quiet. And a lot, of, you know, that's what happens sometimes when you play on the right wing. It can happen because, you know, people are very comfortable passing off their...
Passing right to left, like passing the ball out.
Well, it's not so much that passing right to left. You know, the ball, the ball ends up on your wing quite a bit. And then when you're playing right wing and less left to right, it's less.
Are you putting that down to just people not being as comfortable passing off their left hand?
People are never as comfortable passing off their left hand, mate.
Isn't that, that people will find that very interesting though to listen to as professional athletes thinking that you watch.
Games,
I thought you were going to say I
you
used
see
to
how often how often. The ball gets to the left wing compared to the right wing.
It's
fascinating. And a lot of the action has been Josh Adams' side.
Yeah.
He scored hat-tricks. He's got involved in the game a lot more. And I think the ball just hasn't come to him in some of these games. So I'm excited to see, you know, George is a big game player. He's a guy who's played at the top level in big moments. So, you know, if he can come alive in that semi-final, I'm excited to see him.
And do you think Wales will do it then? Heart of hearts, do you think Wales will sneak past South Africa?
They have to be innovative.
Yeah.
I just don't... I think South Africa, that second half they played against Japan, their just control of possession, control of the advantage line was pretty special. You know, the way they, I think, one ball went about 40 metres.
Mm.
There's no prizes for guessing what Wales will be practising in training this week. Defending driving mauls and scrums, I think.
It's not the beautiful game, is it, watching driving mauls? I mean, it was back in the day when I was playing.
But this is the box's strength. And it's been great to see the Springboks go back to doing what the Springboks do best. I think they at the start of this World Cup cycle, they were probably a bit lost in the way they wanted to play the game. Tried a lot of different combinations. Probably tried to play a bit too much. And that's not the Springboks. The best Springbok sides we've seen... In the history of the game, is a set piece orientated, collision winning, big monstrous packs, just beating
massive
you up on the advantage line.
Yeah.
You know, and they did that against Japan, and Japan just didn't have an answer.
So you're gonna go for Wales.
If Wales get it right, I just think the occasion. Just this is such an opportunity for Wales. Will they ever get a better shot? You know, you could talk about 2011 and.
Did you play? Were you playing that game?
I played that game, yeah. Probably the biggest regret of my career.
Really?
To lose a semi-final by points.
And that was when, obviously, so Sam put in what I would have deemed, I remember watching that game, that was a flipping great hit. And it was just at a time when all the focus had come on, look after the player being tackled and all that. And so Sam gets red carded, changes the course of the game, you know, a la the result yesterday when the same happened.
And
I
isn't it funny
France.
How kind of fate comes full circle?
Yeah.
Wales win by a point off a French red card. It's just crazy how that worked out yesterday. When you think back to 2011, but I just think this Welsh side, if they can do what they've done, and they've hung on in there, you know, let's be honest, they get out of jail card on the weekend against France. That's been their poor performance, but they won. So they found a way to win. So, you know, this side has found a way to win over the last few years. And the last five out of six times they've played against the box, they've won.
So that's a good stat going in for them. In terms of the other semi-final, England play New Zealand, where are you going to go with that? Because, you know, I know realistically who I think is going to win that, and that's New Zealand. But having gone into the semi-final, think that if England win this game, there's absolutely no chance they'll get past New Zealand, but, you know, they'll make a semi. All of a sudden, see the way they come out and play and bossed Australia. And really, you know, Australia didn't look like scoring at all to me. You know, one opportunity they took really well. I suddenly start to have a little bit of belief.
Yeah, England have got every chance. And I think they have to be direct. When you look at the sides who have beaten the All Blacks in recent history, it's usually been the box. And they, again, beat you on the advantage line. It's direct, it's speed of ball, it's just knocking the door down. And they're not the biggest team, the All Blacks.
Mm.
So remember this, you know, you would have played against the All Blacks quite a bit. Very quick, very agile, very fast in their thinking, and their transition from attack to defence is quicker and more efficient than any other team in the world. However, they're not the biggest side. So, you know, if England can utilise Vunipola, Tuilagi, these big ball carriers they do have effectively in the right parts of the pitch, maybe not first phase, maybe not second phase, because the All Blacks will be expecting that, but if they can somehow manipulate their attacking game to bring those guys into the game at points where New Zealand are vulnerable, I think they can cause them problems.
And like George North, actually, those two names, Tuilagi and Vunipola, have been quiet for England during the course of this. You know, whether they've been bossed out of it by the defences. But I suppose the fact that defences have to concentrate so hard on it, individuals, means that space is created elsewhere.
Exactly. But no, England have got every chance. They just have to deliver the perfect game. And, you know, a lot of those All Blacks as well haven't played in games of this magnitude. You know, some of them certainly across the back line, when you look at, it's quite a youthful back line. Yes, they've played in relatively big games for the clubs and they're All Blacks, and they, you know, you don't make that side unless you're a pretty special player. But when you look at experience, certainly across the backs, I think England just have the edge, and you know, you'll see a few tricks up England's sleeve, no doubt.
And one of the Kiwi centres also sports, you know, potentially the worst haircut in world rugby as well. Is it
Goodhue
Mayhew? I mean, it is, but he's a remarkable player. I didn't realise, actually, I had a mullet for about 7 years playing until I looked back at some of my photos, and I clearly had a horrendous mullet. I spoke to Annie, my wife, and said, why on earth didn't you tell me I had a mullet for 7 years? I thought it was just long blonde flowing locks. But mate, so we're both going to be looking for a historic event, which is a first Northern Hemisphere Rugby World Cup final. Fingers crossed that materialises. But for now, I think we've chatted enough about the World Cup. I want to chat to you, understand a little bit more about your journey and career. So let's do that just after this message. Right, a quick question for all of you out there before we crack on with the chat with Jamie. Who wants some free beer? Really simple, who wants some free beer? I thought you might, and lucky for you, I've got a special offer for this week. Thanks to our lovely friends at beer52.com, you can get your hands on 8 free and exclusive craft beers from all around the world. And all you've got to do is go to beer52.com/moody, that's Moody, M-O-O-D-Y, and cover the £4.95 postage. As a loyal listener of the podcast, you'll also get 2 extra free beers. So what can be better than that? 10 beers in total. That's the kind of maths I like, and I'm not very good at maths, but that makes sense. Beer 52 is the world's most popular craft beer discovery club, making it their mission to bring you the best beers from the UK and beyond. Themes in the past have ranged from Germany to Korea, Norway to South Africa, and California to Finland. Better still, there's no lock-in, and you can leave at any time. Your first box will be sent to you next day and will contain beer from all over Europe. Hoppy IPAs, hazy pale ales, refreshing lagers from breweries like Aura in Italy, Ninkasi from France, Tempest from Scotland, Boss Brewing from Wales. What a great name, Boss Brewing, clearly the boss of beers. But you can mix up your light and dark beers if that's more to your taste. Just go to www.beer52.com/moody. That's www.beer52.com/MOODY to get your first case of 8 beers for free. And don't forget, after the whistle, listeners get an extra 2 beers. What can possibly be better than that? Now get on it and let's get back to the podcast. But I want to introduce you you properly, and you can tell me if any of these are wrong, because I've been delving through the archives trying to pull up some stats. But you were born in 1986, Newport, Wales.
Yep.
You went to Cardiff University.
Yep.
You played over 90 times for Cardiff itself.
Yep.
You moved to Racing. Racing 92.
Racing Metro. Back then, but they're Racing 92 now.
Yeah. Perfect. In 2013.
Yep.
How was that? France was nice. Obviously, you picked up the lingo.
Best thing I ever did.
Really?
Yeah.
What was the best bit?
Just leaving Cardiff. I'd never left Cardiff till I was 26.
So born in?
I born in Newport, but I moved to Cardiff when I was 1. So I bought Newport born, but Cardiff bred.
Living on the Champs Elysees.
In Paris, I was behind Musée d'Orsay. In.
You say that very nicely.
Musée d'Orsay. Yeah. Yeah, 7,000 this month.
So after Racing Metro, you went to Quinn's 2015.
Yeah, via Cambridge. So I did the first term at Cambridge. Did the varsity match in December after the World Cup in 2015.
The varsity match, mate. Tell me about that. So that is pretty cool, right? So during your professional playing career, so not only have you you moved from your home club, you've gone out to France, experienced that. You've just come off the Lions tour. and you've then decided to go to successful Lions Tour in Australia. You've then decided to go back to university. You've already, have you passed your...
So 2013 for me,
yeah.
It's best year of my life. So I, well, we won the Six Nations, we beat England, who came for the Grand Slam. They came for the Grand Slam in Cardiff, and it was a special week. I sat my medical finals that week.
The week of the Grand Slam game. Yeah. Did you really?
So on the Tuesday and Thursday, I had my final exams, and so I missed a bit of training on the mornings of those days.
And were the coaches?
Yeah, they were cool with it. That campaign, I was kind of in the team hotel at 5 a.m. every morning working, doing training, getting to bed early and repeating.
Yeah.
And it just felt like a culmination of a eight year project really for me. And it all came to fruition in 2013. I graduated in medicine, which was great, passed my finals, won the tournament in the Six Nations, got picked for a Lions Tour, played in that Vittoris test in Sydney, then got to move to Paris as a single 26-year-old. So
sounds awful.
That sounds awful. So when I reflect on, I guess my career, 2013 was a very special time. And having never left Cardiff till I was 26, it's arguably one of the best things I ever did. Just took myself out of my comfort zone. Different league, different language, different culture, and different people, and just challenged myself. And that's always been my kind of mantra for life, really, is take every opportunity that comes your way.
As I talk about challenging yourself then, because I'm going to carry on going through this list, but so obviously you had that year, 2013, that was your best year. You then went to university, so you then came back to England playing for Quinns, decided to sign up for Cambridge University to study a doctorate, tell me if this is right, or a master's of philosophy in medical science.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Are you still doing that at the minute?
I'm literally going to submit in the next few weeks. I'm about 1,000 words over my thesis, so I've just got to cut about 1,000 words off it. I've seemed to have dragged it out over 4 years, not two, which was meant to be, but c'est la vie. I saw an opportunity after the Rugby World Cup in England to go back into learning, because I'd done my medical degree, I've moved to France for 2 years, and I've not done anything off the field. From moving to France is a challenge in itself. New language, new people, there's pressure on you to, again, be out your comfort zone and push yourselves in other ways. But I always thrived on having something off the field and something to further my life with, and that's mainly been academia, that's mainly been learning, and I missed that in France. And I just saw an opportunity after Rugby World Cup 2015, always fancied Oxford or Cambridge to do the varsity match. It's pretty cool, and it worked out nicely because we, obviously, the World Cup was finishing end of October. I would then go and study, and one of the rules for the varsity match is you have to live in Cambridge or Oxford for the first term, the Michaelmas term is called, to be able to be eligible for the varsity match. So I undertook this master's. It worked nicely because my master's, it was a MPhil, a master's philosophy in medical science. I did it in orthopaedics, which is a field I want to go into in medicine when I finish my playing career.
So is that, so you still want to go into some,
I think
into
so.
Medicine?
I think so.
Yeah.
I'm still undecided. We'll come to that in a bit.
Yeah. Because you're doing a different degree now.
I am doing
as
a different
well,
one
right?
now.
Is it a different master's or a different degree?
It's another master's, but it's in business. So I had this chance and I thought, right, go for it. You know, try and do this master's at Cambridge. And it worked out perfectly. It worked out perfectly. I agreed with Harlequins I wouldn't join up with them until mid-December after the varsity match. And it was one of the most humbling experiences because I went from playing in a World Cup quarter-final. We lost to the Springboks in the 75th minute, if you remember.
Yeah, I do, yeah.
Fury Dupree scores on the corner, breaks Welsh hearts.
Well, you broke English hearts just prior to that
we
as well.
Did,
I didn't want to mention
that. Yeah,
that
was one of the best days of my life as well.
You've had a few good days against
the
English.
There have been some good days. I've had some terrible days as well, but yeah, you've only bought the good ones.
Yeah.
And literally a week later, I was running out at Grange Road in Cambridge, training with lads who play the game for fun.
To amateurs.
No money, no profile, just lads who study, lads who are late to training because they had lectures literally drive their bikes onto the pitch, took their bike down, took their shorts and t-shirt on.
They must have been like apoplectic with enjoyment, excitement with the fact that Jamie Roberts is turning up to play for them in the varsity match.
Yeah, no, it was pretty cool.
Did you feel that?
But I felt more a sense of how can I bring myself down to their level? And it took me a bit of time. I was in training and lads were dropping balls and I was going mental at the boys, and the captain had to pull me to one side. Actually, he was like, "Jamie, you know, you do realise this isn't a little job of these lads here.
Yeah.
I don't do it for a living." So it took me a few weeks to adjust, but it was more for me going back to the reason I loved playing the game, and that was to enjoy. That was to enjoy and have a bond with a group of guys. No pressure, no financial gain, no kind of media exposure. It was back to the core basics of what I loved about rugby, and to do that straight after a World Cup, which is the highest pressure environment as a professional player. That contrast was something I'll remember forever. We lost the varsity match, a bit gutted. I had to come off at half time. My first carry, my opposite number 12 for Oxford, he was captain.
Do you remember his name?
Oh, top of my head, I can't. But he was a good player. But first tackle of the game, 40 seconds in, he's knocked himself clean out because he's tackle me head first.
Because that was his moment, right?
Peach of my quad, yeah. Knocked himself clean out. But he's torn my quad. And my quad has just bled into my knee. My knee is like a small football come half time and I had to come off and we lost. So that doesn't sit too well with me.
Is that one of my worst.
Yeah, it's a niggle.
Because to get back and... So but you've got to remember that you're doing all this whilst playing again. I think that's the thing that I sometimes find hard to take on board, because during my playing days, so I started off at uni at De Montfort studying business because my folks, you know, I think thought business was a good idea and quite frankly, I didn't get the points to do sports science, which is what I wanted to do at Loughborough. So I ended up doing business, but I just couldn't marry the two. I couldn't be disciplined enough to focus on being the best at one and being the best at studying as well. So maybe it's me. So to hear you doing all this whilst you're still playing. So how did you train at Cambridge and play at Quinn's, or train at Quinn's at the same time?
Yeah, no, so I wasn't with Quinn's. That's the thing. I agreed to do a deal with Harlequins that I'd only start with them mid-December after the varsity match. So as soon as the varsity match was finished, I rocked up to Quinn's on the Monday with a dead leg.
Here I am, guys.
Hey, guys.
Sorry about this.
I couldn't play for a week because my knee was still massive.
It was only a week.
It was only a week. But again, it was just great. It goes back to what I said earlier about opportunity. Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad I took it. And, you know, I don't think those opportunities come to you unless you look for them and unless you really kind of dig in and try and find a way to make it work. Like, if I didn't go looking for that Cambridge thing, it wouldn't have happened.
Mm.
The chance to marry the two... And again, you don't ask, you don't get. You know, the fact I was happy to take a bit of a pay cut from Quinn's actually in that first year because I knew I wouldn't be with them for the first half of the season. One, because of the World Cup, and two, because of the Cambridge commitment. And I just saw it as an opportunity to further myself, both, you know, academically and my rugby as well. And it was a nice break. I'd been done full seasons and every tour every summer for probably about 8 or 9 years. I hadn't had a break in pro rugby. The only break I had is when I had surgery. And, you know, operations. It was a nice break. Yeah. When you get a long-term injury, touch wood, I don't get many more. But those are the only breaks I've had, really.
Yeah.
Okay, when you're involved in Test rugby and, you know, play the whole season, then you're on summer tour, November internationals come around, Six Nations, you're playing with your club throughout the year.
And you have a Lions tour thrown in.
Yeah, Lions tours, World Cups every 2 years. I hadn't had a break, so it was a nice, do you know what, 2 months away from pro rugby. It was cool.
And so you took up your master's during that time as well. So that was 2015. You've gone on to have so far 94 caps for Wales. Correct. Played in 2 World Cups, which you mentioned, multiple Grand Slams and Six Nations titles, 2 tours with the Lions in 2009, and you were player of the series. Did that tour in 2009? So you obviously went on and played in 2013. You lost in 2009, which arguably, you know, the Lions shouldn't have done. Did that disappointment in 2009, but maybe personal satisfaction from playing so well, motivate you to desperately want to be on that next one and make sure you get the job right.
Yeah, and the contract. You can see that, actually. I remember the changing room very well, that Loftus, in that second test in 09. I'd never experienced a changing room like that, and I haven't since in my career. Just to see so many, you know, the top players in the game and top players in the UK and guys who've a huge amount of respect for. I was only 21, 22 at the, I was 22 at the time. So I was a kid on that tour. And I'd never seen anyone or group of people just have so little to say. It was dead. Absolutely dead change room. Nothing. Just complete exhaustion and complete feeling of dissatisfaction.
Because it was a game you had in the bag, wasn't it?
And there was in a penalty. The bag, and then, yeah, last minute penalty.
It was Rog, wasn't it? So it was Ryan Nogara's kick.
Rog up and under, went for tackling the ball. Yeah. Mono Steyn comes off the bench.
Kicks it from the halfway line,
and the series is lost. And then, yeah, contrast that. That gave me huge motivation 4 years later. And contrast that to the kind of changing room and whatever, bouncing around in the changing room in Sydney, having been Australia in the third test by 40 points with Daniel Craig. James Bond spraying champagne. Like, it's,
was he in the changing room?
Was he really?
Is that? Did you feel like, okay, rugby's changed at this point?
Well, exactly.
Daniel Craig's in the changing room.
It was pretty cool. There were quite a few lads who were on those two tours.
Yeah,
who I shared that moment with, and that was brilliant. And yeah, I guess those big disappointments in rugby go on to motivate you. Mm-hmm. Like, I certainly off the back of 09, and 09 was a brutal year. You know, I lost a penalty shootout to Leicester in the Heineken Cup.
What a dream. I remember it so well.
Exactly. So within the space of about 3 months, I lost that penalty shootout against your good side, Leicester, in a Heineken Cup semi, which will never happen again. It was one and only time.
It was insane as well, wasn't it? Do you remember? So actually, I remember thinking when they called that, so I'd come off the bench, haven't been injured for ages, and I think you handed me off twice on the way to the try line, which didn't sit down too well with me. And I think Cardiff scored like 3 tries in the space of the 5 minutes that I was on the pitch. It then went to penalty kicks at goal.
Yeah, which will never be seen again.
It'll never be seen again, because actually what, in my head, I thought, all right, penalty kicks at goal, I'll go have a little rest, sit on the sideline, get a water bottle. The reality was actually that 5 people were picked. So your front line kickers go up, front 5, not front 5, but your first choice kickers, first 5 choice, they go. It never even dawned on me that I would be required to take a kicker. I've never kicked a goal, like, other than maybe once or twice in training. No.
Oh, you were next.
I was next. Well, so next. I was two more down. But we got into the forwards, if you remember. Mm. There are guys on
Jordan
Crane
kicked the winner, and Martin Williams
who had an epic season as well. He'd come back from retirement, hadn't he? Yeah. And then went on that Lions tour. I've never felt so heavy legged in all my life. It was the closest I can imagine to being in a
extra
World Cup.
Time was so funny because no one wanted to have the ball.
did you kick?
No, I got subbed about 1 minute of extra time left for Kerry Sweeney, who was on the bench. Yeah. Obviously, Dai Young has looked across our back line and gone, right, who's the worst kicker?
get him off.
Sweeney, on you go. But that was brutal, as was losing a Six Nations title by a last minute O'Gara drop goal in Cardiff. Ireland won the Grand Slam, paraded the trophy around Cardiff, and then the Lions tour happened, and those three things were all in the space of about 3 months. So here I am thinking, what could have been? And that was a huge motivator for me going forward, and I've been lucky to be able to remedy those things. We won a European title with Cardiff the following year. Yes, it was the second tier competition, but it felt like, you know, kind of revenge sort of thing for what happened in 09. I've been lucky to win Six Nations titles and then obviously the Lions tour in 2013. But the one thing I haven't been able to remedy is that World Cup semi-final.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm just desperate for this Welsh side now to go on and win it.
Do you have pangs of frustration, jealousy? Because you were so close to being a part of that squad and being out there with them. Do you still?
5% of me.
Yeah.
I think when I stopped getting picked for Wales initially, it was near enough 95% of me. But you learn to deal with it, and you learn to understand that, you know, your place in that side, the jersey's never yours. You occupy the jersey for a certain amount of time, and then someone else's time comes. And you have to drive those emotions out of you. It's only human to feel them.
Yeah.
And and you should feel them. You know, if you didn't feel them, you're in the wrong sport. But you learn that you had your time. Mm-hmm. And you learn that you come to terms with that, and it takes time. I struggled. I really did struggle, probably in the first 6 to 12 months after the first few campaigns when I wasn't picked for Wales.
When was your last cap?
November 2017, off the bench against the All Blacks. And I haven't been picked since. And there I was playing club rugby, feel like I was playing well enough. And it's tough, mate, it's tough. And I think any test player who doesn't get picked, or any player who doesn't get picked in a side will tell you similarly, it's very tough. But you have to have perspective. You have to have conversations with people, get stuff off your chest, and give yourself another perspective on the game. And you know, the last couple of years, I've managed to do that. So,
is there anything in particular that you've done that's helped you gain that perspective? I know some people go off and, you know, do yoga. Some people have, you know, charity connections. It brings back that perspective. Has there been anything in particular, or just a coming to terms?
Just coming to terms. Coming to terms. I think, you know, having good chats with my dad about it.
Yeah.
Good chats with my good mates. And your best mates definitely keep your feet on the ground, don't they?
Everyone needs them, right?
Everyone needs them.
Yeah.
And, you know, certainly my schoolmates in Cardiff have always been kind of like brothers to me in that respect. And you just speak to players, you speak to coaches.
Would they call you up then, those Cardiff mates, so old schoolmates?
Yes, and you'd have those conversations over a few beers, and you know, they give you the truth.
Yeah.
You know, they give you the truth, and sometimes the truth hurts. But you need to have those conversations to be able to have closure and move on. So, no, I don't think there's anything I've done in particular to help me deal with that. I think it's a case of, and you learn from these things, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, my attitude to rugby and to non-selection now is so much better than it was 18 months ago. And I felt I've grown more respectful of the situation, and I'm a massive Welsh rugby fan now. Whereas 18 months before, I couldn't dare watch Wales play. There's just some emotion inside me that just didn't even want to know how the lads got on, because I wasn't involved, and I had been involved for so long. So it's been a very interesting couple of years emotionally and mentally, but one I've learned a hell of a lot from.
And so, you know, they're challenging times, and having support network and stuff around you. People talk about resilience sometimes as well. I always think when people talk about it, it seems like, well, he's resilient or he's not. Actually, I always think resilience is exactly what you've described there. It's when a series of experiences are put in front of you and you understand how to deal with them. You know, it's like going through 09 and the disappointments of, you know, injury, loss, multiple losses in big matches, you know, help you either refocus and go, right, how do we change this so I can do it again?
I think a lot of those dealing with it, and kind of, it comes in trial and error sometimes.
Yeah.
And understanding your behaviour and understand the way you behave. Like, you know, I'd be in some rugby sessions and I'd be quite selfish about things. And then you go home at the end of the day and go, right, do you know what? I was selfish today. I was selfish today. You look at it objectively and you go, right, that wasn't good. That wasn't good the way I behaved or the way I reacted. That was a product of what happened to me. How can I be a better bloke? And, you know, rugby's about being a good bloke in your environment.
Especially in the teams, right? You know, when you've got to trust a bloke next year on the pitch.
Exactly. And it was through trial and error, I think, I coped and I built resilience in myself.
So we chatted about some of the down times. 2013, you were part of that successful Lions side. You scored in the final match, in the third test, you scored.
Yeah.
So when you won, I remember sitting on Kenny Logan's shoulders in a stadium, I can't remember where it was, about to watch the Manic Street Preachers, and Jamie Roberts comes out on stage for the first time. How cool was that? Because I remember me and Kenny were going absolutely mental. I mean, for you, that must have been awesome. And where's that love of music come from?
Hey, it was an unbelievable experience. And do you know what? And this is a credit to James Dean Bradfield, who's, you know,
lead singer,
songwriter
of the
Manics. Of the Manics. After we won the Grand Slam in 2012, I was sat in a little cafe in Cardiff. I just had an ACL operation. So my first game after that tournament, I did my ACL. We were playing up in Glasgow on the 4G pitch. Popped my knee. It was a bit rubbish, but I was on crutches. I was with all my Cardiff mates, sat in this cafe, Trade Street Cafe, it's near the brewery. And anyway, it was about six or seven of us. And this guy taps me on the shoulder. He's like, "Jamie, don't want to disturb you. Just want to say hugely proud of you the last few months. You've been immense, mate. Happy days." And it was James Dean Bradfield. So wow. Me and my mates are like, what?
That is cool.
How cool is that?
Yeah. Were the Manics a band that you listened to, obviously?
Yeah, see, I grew up, band. Knew yeah. every word to every song on This Is My Truth, Tell Me Yours, and the Phonics as well, you know, Performance and Cocktails. I think those two albums probably were the soundtrack to my youth, certainly. And yeah, it turns out their recording studio was over the road, and he invited me over. I might have told him that I needed a new guitar, which I actually did. I had a really rubbish acoustic guitar, so I was thinking of getting a new one anyway. And he actually gave me an acoustic guitar, which I've since got signed, you know, to Jamie, you've always got a place in the band, which is pretty cool.
Yeah,
you've
lined
a place
up
in my flat.
Yeah, the post-career, mate, it's sorted
exactly,
ready. You know,
exactly. And it turned out they were playing the nights before the test in Australia, and I got injured the week before the first test. Then, you know, there was every chance I was going home, but they kept me out there, and I was very lucky to play in that third test. But obviously, first and second test, I was injured. And he texted me and he was like, "Mate, fancy playing a song with us on stage in Melbourne?" And do you know what? I didn't tell anyone. I didn't ask anyone permission because obviously they could only say no. So I thought, right, I'm going to do this and just deal with
it. That's a ballsy call. So one of my questions was going to be, you know, did you ask? How are they about you going on stage?
Yeah, no, I didn't even ask. I just thought, right, I've got a free night.
Yeah.
Is it going to put stress on my hamstring? Probably not. I'm only going to stand there on stage. So, and it was cool. I just remember going to this hall probably 3 or 4 hours before the gig, and he just hands me a guitar, and we're sat in this little room practicing the chords, and he's singing top of his voice to "You Love Us," which is one of their great songs. And I'm like, but this is just insane. Like, this is kind of another level. And then did it. And yeah, 5 minutes of complete ecstasy, and it's a different feeling to playing rugby. Not one of 30, you're one of five.
Was it more nerve-wracking because of
probably
that?
Probably, yeah, without doubt. And you know, I'm far more confident playing rugby than I am playing the guitar. No doubt they unplugged my guitar, but you still had to try and get cool.
I'm sure they did.
It was cool because the crowd was shouting "Lions," you know, like the Lions, Lions, and it was like, wow, this is proper. And I'm very lucky I got to repeat that last month in Japan.
Of course,
well.
You did it in the World Cup, didn't you? Yeah. I mean, those are uniquely special moments, but you know, only for someone that's also dedicated enough time to learn how to play the guitar. Because if I got up on stage, it'd be vastly different. They would definitely need
chords,
to be unplugged.
Mate, chords. Just learn all the chords and change them between chords. That's all I can do, really.
Tell me. So you didn't ask. Tell me about the team meeting the next day or the next time you were with the lads.
Oh, well, the lads loved it, and the staff loved it as well.
Did they?
Yeah. And, you know, it's...
They play it out on the big screen.
It was... No, they didn't. No. But, yeah, it was one of those, all right, do I ask here and get refused or just crack on and just deal with any consequences? But there weren't any.
Mate, it was a very cool and iconic moment. And obviously an awesome tour for you, culminating in a win. So I'm scrolling through this list of your CV, essentially, but you also speak... fluent Welsh.
Yep.
French?
I went to Welsh school.
You went to Welsh school?
Yeah, conversationally comfortable in French. But yeah, I did all my exams, my A-levels, GCSEs, everything through Welsh.
Wow.
So I went to Glantav School in Cardiff. Very proud of our school. Rhys Patchell is our latest rugby expert.
Is he really?
Yeah.
Another Welsh.
It was a great kind of rugby school. Good rugby teams. We got to tour around the world really with school. You know, when people ask me about favourite memories from school, it was probably going on a rugby tour. We toured South Africa, Australia, Dubai. It was pretty special. I mean, we were in a comp school. We weren't in a private school. So, great, great memories there. And certainly my best mates from my years in school now. So very fond memories.
And you've done a degree in sports exercise science?
Yeah, I did that as part of my medical degree.
I did
the first 3 years full-time.
Yeah.
I did my last 2 years over four, but between those two stints, I did a BSc in sport exercise.
So how many degrees have you got?
I'm studying for my fourth.
Fourth degree, second master's.
Second master's, yeah. So the Cambridge one will be done within a month, hopefully. And then I'm now doing an MBA
at
Loughborough,
mate,
which is the one you wanted to go to.
I did.
Yeah, I don't know, but Loughborough, part-time.
I mean, that's just all the stuff that I've found on you. I mean, that is a monumental CV. I sort of dread to think, you know, what's next. I know, you know, you're still playing at the minute. So playing at Bath, enjoying your time there. What is next? And well, so first, tell me what's next. What's next for you?
Next for me is to enjoy my last year at Bath. I say last year, I signed 2 years here, so it's my second year of a 2 year contract. I'm not quite sure where I'm going to be playing next year, so those are conversations you start having in November, December, I guess.
Would you like to stay? Were you looking?
I think so, if they offer me a contract. Yeah. It's a pretty pretty brutal world out there, pressure.
It's business now, isn't it?
Exactly. I doubt those conversations will start to happen until December, January time. So
Japan? You seem to like it over there.
We'll see. I'll see, you know, who offers me a job. And, you know, I still feel good enough to play at the top level. So, you know, until I feel that, I'll keep... until I feel that's not possible, I'll keep playing. I think there's a family element in it. You know, I want to have kids and I don't have any yet. I've got a little puppy, which is a bit of a baby delayer, I guess, but...
Mate, I've just joined you on the puppy front. I've got a 10-week-old Labradoodle, a couple of hours ago, watching my youngest son, Ethan, play rugby, because he's not had his second lot of inoculations yet. I couldn't put him down, so I had to, sort of wrap him in a blanket. That was my excuse.
Brilliant.
Rough-de-tufty rugby player still on the side of the pitch, holding a 10-week-old Labradoodle.
Yeah.
But so that's keeping you busy.
That's keeping me busy enough. And I just think what's next... I guess I'm turning 33 next month. I'm a realist in the fact that I want to play for another 2 seasons, I think. I'm very kind of honest in the fact that it's guaranteed to finish, and I need to start thinking about the afterlife. And again, it comes back to the way I approach things about opportunity. I've always take an opportunity. Well, if I get a free weekend, I have to travel somewhere, or if I have an opportunity to go somewhere I've never been, I'll take it. If I have an opportunity to try my hand at broadcasting or do something, I'll always take it, because you never know where that opportunity may lead. And I guess for me now, it's a case of doing some really hard thinking, finding out what really makes me tick, and start planting seeds really on the next path.
It's amazing for someone like me that listens to a chap like yourself who's got four degrees, or almost got 4 degrees, is doing 4 degrees, 2 masters. You can play guitar, you've got 2 languages fluently, numerous other lists of things on your CV, and yet you still
don't know what I want to do.
Still don't know. I mean, so that gives me some comfort, actually, having come out of the game myself. But do you think it's harder now for the generations coming through? Is it possible to do something like you've done, where you studied, where you did medicine for 8 years, you're going on to do another? Is that still possible now with the demands on the players in the current game?
Yeah, I look at this 2 ways, and one, yes, I've shown it's possible. Others have shown it's possible. There's lots of players out there doing different things and studying, and we are now in an environment, I think, where it's becoming more fashionable, is probably not the right word, but it's very topical at the minute. We talk about professional sport and mental health and well-being. It's healthy for lads to have other interests away from the game.
Do you believe that? I was going to ask you that, because I think that's key.
Without a doubt, I think it's key. You have to develop as a person. Yes, rugby will allow you to do that to some respect, but it's a finite career. You are very naive, I think, as a young player, to not understand that rugby is guaranteed to finish, and you're guaranteed to have to work for 30 years after you play. We're not footballers. It might end up going that way, but certainly my generation of players, we don't earn the money which allows you not to work ever again. So I think the sooner young players understand that in their young 20s, when they become professional players, the better they can adapt, and the better they can plan, and the better they can deal with that transition out of playing. And some players struggle. It's a tough time, and I'm envisaging a very tough time regardless of how much I've studied and learned away from the field. But I think it's hugely important that players just understand it ain't going to last forever. And rugby, what you've achieved on the rugby field is probably highly unlikely to get you anywhere in the afterlife, per se, in another walk of life.
Mm. You'll certainly never experience any of the same highs and lows, which is, I think, something I've found really hard to come to terms with, is actually, because your highs and lows in a sporting career are each week, and they're so high and they're so low, you know, and they're like that but actually in the world outside, it's just flatline. It's like flatlining the whole time. And you might get one spike somewhere along the way, but it's so difficult. Do you have any concept about how you might replace that adrenaline?
And that's by speaking to former players like yourself and guys like Martin Williams, who I'm quite close with. And they'll tell you can never replace that. Nothing in life can replace sitting in the change room after absolutely emptying yourself on the pitch with a group of lads having a cold beer after a good win or loss or whatever. It's very, very hard to replicate. And this is why, for me, the next year or two involves a lot of thinking, a lot of discussions with other people, and working out what motivates you, working out what makes you tick, regardless of your future earnings or whatever line of work. You just need to find something which you can sink your teeth into, which you enjoy doing and have a passion about. And I'm still trying to find that. It will come to me at some point. It'll take time though. And, I'm happy to try things and learn that I hate them. I think that's as important.
I think that sometimes people forget that actually they spend so long trying to find the one thing again, because we've always had the one thing, right? Yeah. Being a rugby player. So you spend time trying to find that one thing, but actually you've just got to make sure you try things. And because you don't know what it's going to be, and actually you don't know what you're going to love or what you're going to enjoy, or you're going to have an understanding or want to understand more so that you can get better at it, I suppose.
But that's the thing. I might start being a junior doctor and learn that I absolutely hate it. Great experience, because I've learned that I hate it, and I won't always kind of strive to be that thing. So conversely, I might try and absolutely love it and go on to have a long career in medicine. So I've always enjoyed doing things away from rugby and separating the mind and body. If it's probably the best way to put it. I always found rugby very challenging physically, but not actually that mentally challenging. Yes, the 80 minutes on the weekend, but learning the plays, come on, it's not mentally...
For some, that's mentally challenging, mate. I can assure you.
I know,
For us mutes in the forwards, so in learning, especially when you had to go from, you go from your club lineouts, which would take, I don't know, nigh on 3 months to learn, and then you go to international and you just,
The lineout dossier is something I've never...
But is that why your CV is so littered with... letters after your name and attempts to learn that? I remember speaking to you in a coffee shop once, and you were saying that you just hate dead time around training. And
I do struggle with dead time, and I struggle with one, lack of efficiency in my day, and lack of productivity. I just struggle with it. I struggle just sitting there watching telly, just doing nothing, and I don't watch much TV. Do you know what else I hate is long breaks between sessions? It sounds quite weird, but if I come in and have wait till like 8 o'clock and then there's nothing till midday, I really struggle to deal with that. Sitting around for 2 hours of my day doing nothing.
Yeah.
Used to drive me spare.
So what did you fill it with then? What did you do?
I'd be like, right, I need to get all my admin done in 2 hours. So that I could then free up my evening to do something else.
Yeah.
Having lack of efficiency in your life just killed me. And that's the way I always dealt with university. When I was a young player, for example, if I could shift that weight session from 8 till after rugby, which freed up my morning to be able to go on the hospital ward for that half day, I'd do it. I was very lucky. I had people at Cardiff Blues, conditioners, who were great with me and allowed me to do that, and probably very important in my path through medical school, probably more important than I realised. But they allowed me to plan my day efficiently, to make sure I was being very productive with my time and managing my time very well. And it's all about balance. That's probably the key word to, again, when I reflect on what I've achieved. I never sacrificed my social life, because it's easy to do that. I was very busy with rugby, very busy with university, and I had to be very disciplined with my time management. But I would never consider not going out on a Tuesday night with my mates. I just wouldn't have... I'd had 2 beers instead of 10.
Mate, look, we've been chatting now for over an hour, so I think it's probably time to draw to a close. You've had such a... you know, had such a varied career so far, and I know you've got a couple of years left that you're considering, but I just want to wish you all the best with retirement when it comes, with the next couple of years, and enjoying your career and figuring out what it's going to be. But thanks for coming on, more importantly, and sharing it with us.
The smoothest voice in radio.
Radio 4. But to everyone else as well, thanks for listening. Jamie's social media handle is...
Jamie Hugh Roberts, H-U-W, very Welsh.
My social handle is Lewis Moody 7. We've chatted about this. We've all got our playing numbers still. It's such a depressing thought. I've got to move on.
Well, 6/7,
something like that. So it is exactly 7 as well.
There you are. Well, thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Mate, it's a pleasure. Please rate, review, or subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you go to get your podcasts. And of course, After the Whistle is produced in conjunction with Audioboom. Until next time, take care. Cheers.